I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The President of the United States, Barack Obama, will be in Hiroshima this Friday, the first sitting president to visit. Not to apologize, but according to his spokesman, Josh Earnest, to send a much more forward-looking signal for his ambition of realizing the goal of a planet without nuclear weapons. Our guest this hour, Carol Gluck, professor of history at Columbia, says that the Japanese ignore everything before Hiroshima and the Americans ignore everything after Nagasaki. Why did it take 71 years for a U.S. president to visit? What is the atomic bomb narrative in the United States? What is it in Japan? Should we have dropped a second bomb 3 days later in Nagasaki? Should the president be visiting both locations? We also invite you to go to our Facebook page today where we will read your responses during the course of this hour. Was the U.S. justified in dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima? And what about Nagasaki 3 days later? We're interested in your responses to this. And you just go to the Kathleen Dentro. But first, to put us back in time, if you were alive on August 7th of 1945, listening to CBS on the radio, you would have heard this, and it's remarkable for how little we knew 24 hours after the atomic bomb. Alan Jackson filed a special report as news outlets were trying to determine the magnitude of the devastation.
Tokyo admits extensive damage caused by the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. New air attacks have been thrown against Japan. Washington and other allied capitals are buzzing with speculation about the new bomb and its possibilities. Now here's Alan Jackson with a CBS feature, News of the World.
Almost 24 hours have passed since we first learned of the atomic bomb and its use against the city of Japan. And even now, after hearing many times the description of this new weapon, its capabilities continue to tempt human imagination. Our senses reel in awe from the staggering import of this new advancement in science. Words written and spoken on the subject since the announcement first came from President Truman about 11 o'clock yesterday morning already are encyclopedic in volume. And yet the subject grows more interesting and fantastic with each new detail, however minute. What this new discovery can mean for a peacetime world, even though its commercial possibilities lie years, if not generations ahead, is almost beyond the comprehension of mere humans. One bomb has been tested, and results were noted for hundreds of miles around. One bomb has been dropped on a Japanese city. So far, headquarters hasn't been able to determine the amount of damage caused, or photographic planes that flew over the ill-fated town of Hiroshima several hours later still were unable to pierce the heavy pall of smoke and dust that clouded out that particular spot of Japan. Tokyo Radio this morning finally acknowledged the use of the atomic bomb against Hiroshima and admitted that extensive damage was done. Apparently, the damage was so great that the Japs aren't sure yet what hit the place, for they speak of bombs in the plural, though headquarters tells us that only one bomb was dropped. And a few moments ago, the Japanese Domain News Agency, in another broadcast from Japan, said that the atomic bomb was dropped by parachute and exploded in the air before reaching the ground. That's a Japanese explanation. Earlier, in an indirect reference to the amount of damage caused, the Japs announced that all railroad service in the Hiroshima area had been canceled. Well, that, at the moment, is about all we know of what happened when the atomic bomb landed in Hiroshima, Japan. More figures and revealing descriptions of the damage undoubtedly will be available later, when the skies above Hiroshima clear sufficiently for our airmen to fly over and view the results of their work.
From CBS Radio, August 7th, 1945, 24 hours after the atomic bomb was dropped. Our guest this hour is Professor Carol Gluck. She is professor of history at Columbia University, teaches about modern Japan from the late 19th century to the present. She teaches international relations, post-war Japanese history, public memory in Japan and the West, and she is the author of the forthcoming book, past obsessions, World War II in history and memory. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I would imagine we'll have quite a few as the historic day arrives when the president visits Hiroshima on Friday of this week. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Please go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and answer the questions that we've asked you, because we're interested in what you think about what happened on those days 71 years ago in Japan. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Gluck, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
It was remarkable to me in listening to that broadcast how we really didn't know exactly what was going to happen, what the effects were going to be after we dropped the bomb. Certainly news reports didn't know, did they?
I don't think anyone really knew, including the scientists who created the atomic bombs. I don't think anyone really knew what the consequences and outcomes would be. And I think the broadcast made it pretty clear that this bomb, what did he say, tempts human imagination?
Yes.
Beyond the comprehension of mere humans. I mean, in a sense, there was he said it was very exciting with every new detail, more interesting and fantastic,
right.
But it was also clear that no one really knew. And I think that's true on the Japanese side. We know it's true on the Japanese side as well as the American side. So the atomic bomb was a new technology, a new way of bombing cities, and the consequences of that, of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, will only become known in the following days and months and years.
Mm-hmm. You have said that the Japanese ignore everything before Hiroshima and the Americans ignore everything after Nagasaki. There's a lot in that statement, so let's go to it.
Well, it's a little bit more narrow than that, in the sense that you talked about the atomic bomb narratives earlier. It's the atomic bomb story that I'm talking about. The Japanese atomic bomb story starts on August 6, 1945. And the narrative is that the atomic bombs gave post-war Japan its mission for peace. The American story, atomic bomb story, ends with Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. And the narrative is that the atomic bombs ended the war and saved American lives.
Mm-hmm.
So in the story, in the atomic bomb story, the Japanese story is missing the aggressive war and invasion of China that Japan conducted, total war against China from 1937 and aggression before that. And the war was, of course, the reason that the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan. So the war is missing from the atomic bomb story in Japan, and the American story stops before the horrific sort of physical and physiological consequences of the bomb and before the nuclear arms race. So each of the stories is, if you like, half the story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not that Japanese ignore what happened before. It's the atomic bomb story that ignores on both sides. And the American story is very clear, and we're going to get phone calls about this, I can promise
you.
Yes,
so I'm sure we will.
I can promise you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'll say something else about why we get phone calls, and we get the same kind of phone calls in Japan if we were on the radio there. And the reason is, and I find this very surprising in terms of all of the history and memory of the Second World War, it's surprising that this is one story that hasn't changed in 71 years.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, these two atomic bomb stories haven't changed. The Holocaust story has changed. The story of the former sex slaves of the Japanese Imperial Army, the so-called comfort women, has changed, but not the atomic bomb story. And it's a puzzle as to why that is, but it's one of the reasons why it's such an emotional and a polemical subject in both countries. When you talk about the decision to drop the bomb and or the decision to surrender, decision to drop the bomb on the U.S. side, the decision to surrender on the Japanese side.
Mm-hmm. When you say that it gave post-war Japan its mission for peace, didn't we, in a sense, give Japan its post-war mission?
Well, we helped make this narrative. We helped create the Japanese story or memory or narrative, if you like, of the Second World War. And we did that, the Americans, it was an Allied occupation of Japan, which began just a few weeks after the, a couple of weeks after the end of the war in August of 1945. It was basically an American dominated occupation. And the Americans actually guided the Japanese with fairly strong authority that the military occupation held to write what the occupation authorities called a true history of the war in the fall of 1945. And the war of which they were to write that true history was renamed from the Greater East Asia War, which was the war the Japanese had fought, and Greater East Asia referred to everything in the wartime Japanese empire from the Pacific Islands to the borders of India. They renamed it to the Pacific War, and the Pacific War began at Pearl Harbor in 1941 and ended with the surrender in August 1945. So that happened to have been the Japanese-American War, not the war that Japan had initiated with China, and it was, of course, the China War that had been the reason for Japan bombing Pearl Harbor in the first place. But the reason that the Americans... Of course, it was the war the Americans fought against Japan, so that made sense. But it also made sense because, as you suggested, the Americans were there to turn Japan into a peaceful and democratic nation. Mm-hmm. So the mission for peace on the American side wasn't the bomb. It was the war. But for the bomb story on the Japanese side, it was the never again commit right. this error, as it says engraved on the stone in front of the cenotaph at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. Never again repeat the evil or the error. So they overlapped. And the American story was very comfortable for the Japanese because it looked forward. It didn't look back on aggressive war and atrocities. It looked forward to peace and democracy. So it was a co-created narrative. Americans, in order to produce this to help produce anyway this peaceful and democratic Japan, and for Japan to look forward rather than think about what they had just done, if you like, right. in terms of warfare.
Yeah. In terms of the president's decision to go, you have said, I think it's a very good decision, a decision that probably would have made sense to do earlier. I think the question is why it took 71 years for this to happen, and you say there are answers to that. What are they?
Well, I think I've sort of given them. One of the answers why the U.S. sitting president hasn't gone, it's while he's in office, has to do with the tenacity, the stickiness of the atomic bomb narrative in the United States.
Hmm.
I mean, it's a very sticky story, and there are a lot of people who are very invested in it. And for decades, of course, it was the veteran story, and not just the veterans involved in the Pacific, but there wasn't a serviceman, or there were very few, I guess, servicemen who were stationed wherever they were at the end of the war in 1945 who didn't feel or didn't express a feeling of relief when they heard about the bomb because they knew they could go home. And that was sort of immortalized in a book by Paul Fussell called Thank God for the Atom Bomb, which talked about how the American military felt. So the veterans across the decades did feel that the atomic bomb had helped to end the war sooner and saved American lives, including perhaps their own. And that tenacity, that sticky story, came to a head in 1995 on the 50th anniversary of the end of the war when the Smithsonian Institution right. planned an exhibit of the Enola Gay, which was the bomber that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And there was a great hue and cry on the part of veterans associations and the Air Force, etc., because that original exhibit had included some of the horrors that were experienced by the people who suffered the radiation of the bomb, and also included reference to the nuclear arms race. So 50 years later, you couldn't do that. You couldn't fix the story in public. Now it's 71 years on, and the veterans and the of that conflict and their sons and even their grandsons now are not as invested, or maybe they don't even know, the younger people don't even know the story about the bomb. They know the mushroom cloud. But they don't know about Truman's decision necessarily. And if they do, they've also been exposed to anti-nuclear opinion waves of generations. So they don't feel, they think about the atomic bomb in terms of nuclear war, if you like, or nuclear weapons, more than they do the end of the war. So now two things have happened. It's 71 years later, generations are changing. And the second thing that happened is President Obama has staked his first major foreign policy speech in Prague in 2009 on a world free of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has been policy for the Obama administration, and that's why the American ambassador went to the Hiroshima commemoration in 2010, and that's why Secretary of State Kerry went a couple of months ago. So this has been building up within the Obama administration. I think that the government agreed, if you like, if that's the right word, to have him go because it is, as the spokesman said, this is a forward-looking moment.
Right.
And the future to which we are looking forward is a nuclear-free future.
Do you expect the president to give a meaningful, very important speech, or do just perhaps lay a wreath?
I expect him to lay a wreath and flowers.
Mm-hmm.
I expect him to make a statement about a world without nuclear weapons and never again commit the error or the evil of nuclear warfare. You said, was it be meaningful or important? It's meaningful. It's meaningful symbolic memory politics to make that statement. And it's the statement that the Prime Minister of Japan, who is a conservative prime minister, is ready to make too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a controversial issue to be against nuclear warfare, especially in Japan. Then you asked if it would be an important statement. It's not going to revise the history, and it's not going to inform subsequent generations on both sides of the Pacific who don't know that history. So maybe not important in that way, but of symbolic value and meaning. And I think that's how the Japanese public, that's how the polls are showing, that most Japanese are glad that the president is visiting Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm. A 91-year-old survivor of Nagasaki said on Japan's national television recently, "We are not asking for an apology. All we want to see is him lay flowers at the Peace Park and lower his head in silence. This would be a first step toward abolishing nuclear weapons." Would most Japanese share that sentiment, Professor?
Definitely that bowing his head. The Japanese, the government, and also most of the Japanese in the opinion polls are not expecting an apology. They do want the head bowed and the statement about anti-nuclear weapons. The last part of that survivor's statement about the first step to abolishing nuclear weapons, that is a hope that all of the survivors of the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki have felt and marched for and worked for. Now, all of their protests and all of these things that have happened have not eventuated in a world full of nuclear weapons. So it's a hope, and it's the reason that that so many Japanese are as fervent against nuclear war as they are. So the first part of it is right, bowing your head and acknowledging the enormity of the atomic bombings. The second part is remains to be seen as to whether this is the first step or another step, let's say, in abolishing nuclear weapons around the world.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them momentarily. We're talking about the president's visit to Hiroshima on Friday of this week. The dropping of the atomic bomb, he being the first sitting president to visit Hiroshima, not going to Nagasaki. We'll ask Professor Gluck if she thinks he really should have visited both places. The meaning of this trip, what you would like to have him say, the necessity of dropping the bomb, the narrative that the Americans have adhered to for 71 years, and the narrative that the Japanese have concerning the atomic bomb, which he has beautifully just outlined for us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, we'd love to have you go there, if you would, please. The Kathleen Dunn Show. We've asked a couple questions there. Was the U.S. justified in dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima? What about Nagasaki 3 days later? We're interested in what your response is to that. Professor Gluck is professor of history at Columbia University. She teaches Japan from the late 19th century to the present. She teaches international relations, post-war Japanese history, public memory, Japan, and the West. Tons of phone calls coming in. We'll be with you momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls now as we talk about the president's visit to Hiroshima. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ray in Rhinelander is our first caller. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi.
Professor, thank you for an enlightening presentation here. It's answered a lot of my questions already. You definitely have done a lot of work on this, and I can't thank you enough. My concern about this is mainly, once again, in all wars, the civilians suffer the most. You know, past, present, and future, even now it's going on in the world. Is there a presentation that can be presented somewhere online here in America for people to see the drastic after effects, and from the time that those bombs were dropped, the black rain, the radiation experiments that they did after the fact, and that's why we got some of our scientific knowledge from that to this day. But once again, the civilians always suffer the most casualties in the long run when this type of analogy is presented. When will it ever stop?
Well, I think that you make a really important point, which is to say that the civilians, and this really changed in the Second World War. In the Second World War, there's more than 60 million people were killed, and probably more than half of them were civilians.
Mm.
And this was a change in scale and magnitude. From earlier wars, including the First World War. And so that's the first point, that you're right about civilian suffering. This was total war, and civilians were, and as they say, innocent civilians, right? Because they were in so many cases. And the second point that you point out is that the practice of what they called city bombing or area bombing or carpet bombing, indiscriminate civilian bombing it's sometimes called, this was a practice of warfare that was done by all of the belligerents in the war. The Japanese did it in China in the late 1930s, the Germans in England, the Americans and the British in Germany, and all and the Germans in the Netherlands. The bombing of cities was an enormous a part of the Second World War. And some 63 cities had been firebombed already, or, well, maybe 61 or so, in Japan before the atomic bombs. And so the atomic bomb, about which we really talk very often in moral terms, should we have dropped this? Was this a moral act? Can it be justified? Actually is our questions that should be asked about the civilian bombings, the carpet bombings, the fire bombings. Because, in fact, the atomic bombs, both the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which were two different technologies, were the latest technological device, the newest kind of bomb, to continue the practice of bombing cities. In other words, it's not a new tactic or strategy, it's just a new technology. So the atomic bombs were, in fact, a subset of civilian bombing. And so if we question the morality of civilian bombing, then we need to talk about all of the firebombings practiced by every side. Now, there were some consequences to people did know about that, about the consequences, because in all of the conflicts, and they were quite a lot of them since 1945, carpet bombing, civilian bombing, city bombing has not been practiced. That's the origin of the so-called smart bombs, which are not so smart. They have large numbers of civilian, what they call collateral damage. So at least that's been acknowledged. Now, what you say is if we were to show Americans the bodily consequences of atomic warfare, the black rain, all of the things one sees when one goes to Hiroshima, how would they feel? Well, we actually know that because in the 1950s, not in the 40s, but in the 50s, the Americans began to see those things. Already in 1946, they'd read John Hersey's Hiroshima, which was stories of the survivors. So Americans really began to understand the consequences of nuclear war. And the question now, I suppose, is do younger Americans see those images if they don't go to Hiroshima? Because those images are no longer in the media.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, before we go back to our many phone calls, about how Japan has wrestled with its own history of wartime atrocities. I was interested in the mayor of Nagasaki in 1990 being shot and wounded by a man described as a right-wing nationalist after he suggested that the emperor bore some responsibility for World War II. A city assemblyman in Nagasaki founded a museum to commemorate the Korean laborers who were conscripted to work in wartime factories in Nagasaki, and it also features Unit 731, Biological and Chemical Warfare Research Facility, where Japanese scientists experimented on human beings in China. Have the Japanese wrestled with the morality of their actions?
I think that over the decades, and particularly since the end of the Cold War, since 1989, Mayor Motoshima of Nagasaki, who was attacked, as you said, spoke out after 1989. And what happened in 1989, we think of as the end of the Cold War, but it was also the year that Emperor Hirohito, who had been the wartime emperor and the post-war emperor, died. And so the mayor said, I think the emperor had war responsibility, and so a right-wing nationalist attacked him. But the polls showed already in that same year that already weeks after the emperor's death, that 25% of the Japanese also thought the emperor had war responsibility. And since the 1990s, a lot of these issues, the sex slaves, the comfort women, mm-hmm. the Nanjing massacre, the Koreans who were also bombed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Hiroshima particularly, there's been a lot more of this of knowledge and acknowledgement among the Japanese public, not the government, and not particularly this government, some earlier governments to some extent, but not this government, which is nationalistic and conservative. But the delayed confrontation with the bad past had a reason for it, and the simplest way to put that reason is the U.S.-Japan alliance, which basically froze that story that I mentioned, mm-hmm. Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima, in place. And it was a congenial story, as Japan, post-war Japan, was peaceful, democratic, and prosperous. So after the end of the Cold War, and after the death of the emperor, and after the rise in power of other Asian nations, those nations that had suffered the atrocities of Japan, now Japan had to confront its actions in Asia. It was no longer the Japanese-American war, Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. Mm. So there's a chronology to this that is very important.
Right.
It comes out of geopolitics. It's not that the Japanese are particularly benighted. There's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Japanese are always compared to the Germans, it's a different chronology in Germany and has its own reasons.
Right. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, I want to thank you and your guests for what you just commented on. I think both sides have a lot of apologizing to do, but I'd like to throw out a little factoid before I get into that. Most people are not aware that our military was considering, when they were planning the dropping of the bombs, they were considering putting whistles on those bombs so that people who were not necessarily killed immediately by the bombs would at least be blinded by looking up and wondering, well, what's that whistling sound? And they decided that was a little too cruel, so they didn't put the whistles on the bombs. And I've read that in a great book. I can't think of the name of it right now, but most Americans are not aware of that, how vicious we were actually planning to make that. You know, if you can imagine an atomic bomb being worse. Well, imagine all the people in the surrounding areas all being blinded.
Can you confirm that, Professor?
No, I can't. Not because I deny it, but because I don't know it.
Okay.
But I would say this about a lot of the things that were contemplated during the war are really bizarre. So that doesn't sound to me beyond the range of imagination. But it was also a total war, a war to the death. And people, they didn't feel that there were, they didn't feel the limits that you were suggesting we would now feel. Like, again, you imagine something worse. So it's possible that it happened. But I think actually that that fact, which is interesting and I'm glad to learn it, probably belongs in the category that we began the program with, which is no one really understood the atomic
mm-hmm.
bomb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Ray. Go ahead.
Okay, I think, of course, Mr. Obama should apologize. I'm just stunned by the fact that he's already said he's not going to apologize. But also, the Japanese should apologize for their behavior prior because of their treatment of POWs, especially the American POWs on the death marches, mm-hmm. and the treatment of the comfort women and their treatment of the Chinese. I mean, both sides have a lot of apologizing to do, and unless somebody starts it, the apologies aren't going to come. So I would beg Mr. Obama, please apologize, and then go to Fukushima and see a modern-day nuclear bomb.
Okay, Ray, thank you very much for your call. We have tons of calls coming in. Chuck in Northwest Wisconsin. Hi, Chuck.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm an 80-year-old geezer, I guess I call myself, that lived through Pearl Harbor. And I remember so much because we were on a trip to southern Minnesota and into Iowa to visit some farm people. And we heard it when we got to their home because we did not have a radio.
Mm-hmm.
But my reaction to the atomic bomb dropping and people visiting is very simple. It's three words. Remember Pearl Harbor. Mm.
Professor Gluck.
On the apology or on Remember Pearl Harbor?
Remember Pearl Harbor, okay. That people...
Well, actually, it's linked to the apology question of the listener before, because I've been thinking a lot about this apology question, because there has developed since the Second World War a kind of culture of the politics of apology
mm-hmm.
that didn't exist before, I have to say, where heads of state apologize to their own people or to other peoples. A lot of the politics of apology developed through World War II memory, Holocaust and otherwise. And it's become customary to apologize. And I realize that there's a demand, for example, for a government apology to the former sex slaves, to the comfort women. There was a demand for the U.S. president to apologize to the Japanese Americans who were interned
mm-hmm.
in camps during the
mm-hmm.
war. And these kinds of apologies have come to seem very reasonable. They are apologies to the victims of these acts, actions, and atrocities. But then I started to realize that, you know, I haven't heard people apologize for, let's call them, acts of war. In other words, I don't think that Japan will ever apologize for Pearl Harbor, and my guess is that the United States will never apologize for the atomic bombs, not because they're not sorry now, but because if you apologize now, it suggests that you should have been sorry then. So I'm beginning to think the politics of apology, which is this is thought that I've had since the Obama visit was announced, the politics of apology has its limits. That said, certainly, if you follow my logic about apologizing to victims, President Obama could apologize to the survivors of the atomic bombings. He could apologize to the people that in Japanese are called the hibakusha in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That would be consonant with the apologies to former comfort women, because they're apologies to the victims. But the reason I think it's not going to happen, and it's not even expected in Japan, is because it brings the possibility of apologizing for the atomic bombs themselves too close. And that is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. And I believe Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was asked to yesterday, actually, in Japan, when he was talking about the recent murder of a woman in Okinawa, linking an American worker at a U.S. military base, and chastised the president for that. But he was also asked whether he would make a reciprocal trip to Pearl Harbor, and he said he had no current plans for a visit.
Exactly. This is a nationalist and conservative prime minister of a nationalist and conservative government, and you can imagine that the same thing is true that made presidents reluctant to visit Hiroshima makes him reluctant to visit Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Japanese are actually I think they're the largest international group of visitors at Pearl Harbor. The Japanese go to Pearl Harbor all the time, but you can be sure that Prime Minister Abe will not go to Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chuck, for the call. Wallace in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Wallace.
Howdy. I'll make this short as I can. I'm a World War II veteran, and I was a naval flyer at this time. Now, listening to your program, I get the cold chills and goosebumps. The figure was tossed around quite a little about the possibility, if we had to invade Japan, that there could be in the neighborhood of 1 million casualties. I'm assuming that would count on both sides. So the few of us World War II veterans left that could possibly have been in that, we like to think that perhaps our lives were saved by this action. Mm. That means I don't condone the bomb, but I'm just referring to how we felt at that time.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, don't leave, Wallace. When you heard the news of what we had done, how did you follow the news? Was it what a great relief, this is over for us now, the Japanese have resigned? Was there a lot of news reporting about what the aftermath of the bomb was or not?
Well, at that moment, before the ugly details come out, you know, of the damage,
yeah.
Sure, it was a relief. You know, you let out a breath of relief. Well, now the invasion is not going to happen, maybe, see?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. It was a profound relief.
Mm-hmm. Professor Gluck.
It makes perfect sense to me historically,
right,
that it would have been a profound relief. There's no question that lives would have been lost, and potentially the lives of someone like Wallace as a naval flyer in a land invasion of Japan. The numbers are a little dicey because the million figure doesn't actually come up until, I think it's 48 or something like that. I think the figures, I'm not quite clear, but I think there were something like 250,000 on each side, something like that. Still, that's a lot of people, so you don't have to quarrel about numbers. The idea of saving American lives by bombing Japan until it surrendered, there was a third bomb, atomic bomb, being prepared. It would have been dropped in early September. I mean, there was no sense that the U.S. was going to stop until Japan surrendered. So absolutely, Wallace is right, and that's the view of most of the veterans, and we have to understand that.
Right. Oh, yes, we do. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. This hour, the program, Professor Carol Gluck is with us, professor of history at Columbia University. She teaches modern Japan from the late 19th century to the present. She teaches international relations, post-war Japanese history, public memory in Japan and the West. She is also author of the forthcoming book, Past Obsessions, World War II in History and Memory. Because the president is going to be in Hiroshima on Friday of this week without an apology for the dropping of the atomic bomb there, but in kind of a solidarity with the Japanese people, we're talking in the memories, particularly from those of you who have been kind enough to call in who served in World War II, are still, understandably, incredibly strong. Our decision to drop the bomb has been examined. No sitting president has been to Hiroshima in 71 years, and we're looking at atrocities committed by the Japanese. We're looking at the morality of this, the apology. Should there be an apology? What does it mean to apologize? Is it appropriate here? What should the president say? Well, the list goes on, and we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And please go to our Facebook page. I think these are certainly some of the big questions, continue to be big questions of our time. And we on Facebook have asked whether the U.S. was justified in dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and then 3 days later on Nagasaki. What do you think? We'll go to more calls and many more comments coming in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls to Alan in Madison next. Hello, Alan.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you, Alan?
Well, I just wanted to share. I was in World War II. I was in a staging area in the Philippines, and it was very common knowledge that we would be going into Japan in September. Mm. And I'm very aware, well, boy, what are you, the night that of the bombing, what did we celebrate? But anyhow, I'm very aware that I have always felt that the bombing was done to see if this would stop the need for the invasion, because we had armament galore on the southern tip of Samar.
Mm. And stay with us, Alan, if you don't mind. We do World War II shows frequently. You'd be a good guest for us to have on at some point, so Scotty's going to ask if you wouldn't mind joining us at a future show. Professor.
Well, everything that Alan actually echoes what Wallace said, too,
right.
is absolutely right. I mean, a land invasion was planned. The date wasn't necessarily known or certain, but and the celebrations the night that they heard about the bomb is also, as I said, was pretty universal.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had an enemy, and I guess during war you have an enemy, and it becomes a faceless enemy, doesn't it?
Well, I think all enemies are rendered. I think one of the things that war does, is particularly total war of the sort that was waged in World War II, it renders the enemy not only faceless, but inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a terrible thing. It may be one of the most awful things, really, that they are dehumanized. They are unpeopled.
Right.
And then all these things that you do to them can be somehow dealt with, if you like, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
because they're not human beings.
Yeah. Oh, you got to ask, haven't we lived long enough to get this darn thing figured out, huh? I don't know.
One hopes.
Yeah. All right, we have a number of Facebook messages coming in. Mike sends this. You're damn right the U.S. should have and was correct to drop the A-bomb on Japan. My wife and my father's were in my wife's and father's were in Germany at the end of the war in Europe. They were not brought home because the U.S. was willing to see if we had to invade Japan. They were waiting to see. If Truman would not have dropped the bombs, my wife and I probably would not be alive. God bless President Truman and all those who lost their lives in World War II. Pat sends this message. My dad finally talked about his service in World War II at the 50-year anniversary of the D-Day invasion. When he talked about when Harry dropped the bomb, he broke into sobs because it meant that he could go home and not have to go to Japan to fight. In our 90-minute talk, he wept many times.
I think that's the view, and I think that's the view, as we said, of most veterans. But then we have to take it further. I think you've asked the questions. We know why the bomb was dropped. We know the mindset of bombing civilians and using a bomb that you built to be used. So then the question becomes, how do you remember the bomb? How do you deal with the nuclear, the possibility of nuclear war, and knowing what we do know about what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And that's a different question.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different question. It goes in a different direction. And that's the direction I think that President Obama is concerned with.
Well, he has the occasion to say something pretty profound, doesn't he? He's good at that.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be, I don't know how long it's going to be. I think we know what the content is going to be. It may be very profound because it may be very impassioned.
Yeah.
And we know the thrust of it, which has to do with a world free of nuclear weapons.
Kimmy on Facebook writes, when I visited Hiroshima in 1980, the death toll attributed to the bomb was still rising and included second-generation cancer sufferers. Has the death toll finalized still then, since then, or is it still rising? Do you know, Professor?
I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. It was clearly a rising curve in the years after the war. At this point, I don't know the answer, and I my guess is it's not rising. But the suffering and the into unborn children, et cetera, or the subsequent cases of leukemia and things of that sort, that's documented, no question. And it's also documented in it's not just nuclear war. It's in the area around Chernobyl and sure to be in the area around Fukushima.
Hmm. Can you tell me, just give us an update on current politics in Japan. Is the prime minister currently attempting to change the constitution so that the peacetime mission is altered?
Well, now you're getting to the politics. We talked a lot about the memory of the bomb, but what about nuclear politics today, or if you like, security, military politics? This prime minister has indeed shifted Japanese policy in the direction that enables Japan to participate in acts of quote-unquote collective self-defense, which means to the Japanese who oppose this view, and many of them did, that Japan might have to go to war in support of its ally, the United States, against a third party. And that is a departure from what most Japanese wish. It is not a departure from Japanese government policy, because Japanese government policy has, over the decades, inched up an inch toward a greater military preparedness and readiness, and indeed even action. So this is not a pacifist government. Now, taking the other side, we've talked about President Obama and his hopes for a nuclear-free future, but I think that the U.S. has just recently decided to upgrade its entire nuclear arsenal to the tune of something like, I don't know, $1 trillion or $3 trillion.
Ooh.
So wait. That's why I said that the hope of the survivor of Nagasaki, that this is the first step toward the end of nuclear war, is not at all clear.
Right.
On either part. I mean, that Japan is not a nuclear power, but Japan is increasingly a militarily prepared power allied with a nuclear power, which is the United States.
Mm-hmm. Steve in Madison, hi.
Hi, yeah. I just had one little factoid that I've never heard mentioned, but my dad was born in 1906. So when the war started, he was 35, and he was considered too old for the draft. And by the time 1945 came around, he got his draft notice. So, you know, the United States, the armed forces were certainly cognizant of the fact that they had to keep raising the draft rate because, you know, people were dying. So,
yes.
I guess I just wanted to point that out, that the United States did not have an inexhaustible supply of soldiers. And if we had invaded Japan, I mean, you know, in some odd ways, I can almost am thankful for the bomb, because if my dad had gone, I might not be here.
Right.
Yes. Well, you know, not only did we keep expanding the draft, but almost every one of the countries involved in this war kept on doing what they were doing right to the bitter end. And in fact, the U.S. Air Force firebombed other Japanese cities after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That hadn't stopped. So you're absolutely right about the kept on doing it. And for us, nobody had an inexhaustible supply of men. Certainly the Japanese didn't. That's why they used the so-called kamikaze and the human torpedoes. They didn't have an inexhaustible supply of materiel either.
Thanks, Steve, very much for your call. Again, we direct you to our Facebook page. I'm really interested in your thoughts about this. We've asked a couple questions for you to respond to, so it can be a simple response on Facebook. But your thoughts about all that we've talked about this hour, which is pretty important. I'll be very interested to hear what the president has to say on Friday when he is in Hiroshima. Professor, when's your book coming out?
Next year.
Oh, next year. I'll look forward to it. I'll bet it's good.
Well, you know, after this, there's some things I want to change in it. Because I've learned something by thinking about this now.
Yeah, right.
Such as the limits on the politics of apology, et cetera, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for wonderful questions. I really want to thank your listeners.
Thanks. Yeah, they're good, aren't they? Professor Carol Gluck, she's a professor of history at Columbia University. She teaches modern Japan, late 19th century to the present, public memory. She teaches post-war Japanese history. And we thank her for joining us on this important couple days before first sitting president visiting Hiroshima. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this show. Thanks to Scotty for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News coming up, we'll return and talk about bullying.